Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linadnoutsi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me too. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Thea. How are you doing?
I am well, thank you. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm very much invigorated by the sun, I have to say.
Yes, it's quite a nice change, isn't it?
Yeah, it's wonderful because November gets a really bad press. And actually today it's just completely beautiful.
It is. Oh, well, that's nice and upbeat of you. Well done.
Well, you know, all the trees are in their autumn beauty, as it were. And, you know, there's sun and there's blue sky.
I have a rose bush that is in full bloom at the moment. And I don't know if that's quite odd or whether that's normal.
It's really weird. The poor old, I mean, when I do that, I have to stop doing it. But my son told me to stop doing it because I go, oh, my gosh, that's in bloom. And he's like, oh, no, really? And he really over it. So I have to stop doing it. And actually, the wonderful Montague Don said you would spend your whole time saying, oh, hang on, that's not supposed to be flowering. So we just take advantage of it. The roses are so confused.
Yeah, just try to enjoy it.
Yeah, I've still got roses that are out. And the dahlias were very late this year. Should we talk about this for like the whole podcast?
Yeah, I feel I should probably say that it's not just going to be you and me rattling around our gardens today. Today we are joined by Toby Lichtig, the TLS's fiction and politics editor. Hello, Toby.
Hello.
And by David Horsepool, who looks after history, among other things, sport as well, I think. Hello, David.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome one and all. And we're all here because it's time for the TLS's, I'd like to say famous, legendary, something like that. The TLS's Books of the Year Roundup.
Yeah, it's legendary within the TLS. Does that count?
Well, legendary always makes me think that it doesn't actually happen, doesn't actually exist, but it does. It does. It happens every single year. And a bunch of esteemed contributors tell us what they've been most impressed by over the past 12 months. That's the gist. But David, you put this feature together and it seems to get bigger every year, does it? I mean, how many do we have this year?
I think it seems to get bigger every year, but oddly enough, I think there are exactly the same number of people this year as there were last, i.e. 65 people, which is still probably quite a lot.
It's a good number.
It's impressive, isn't it? And thank you very much to all the contributors who contributed.
Exactly, drawn from around the world and across disciplines. Shall we have a quick recap of the rules then, whether or not they are adhered to?
Well, I asked them not to go on too long, so to give me 150 words. And what I say is they're welcome to choose more than one book. We prefer books published this year. You would have thought you wouldn't need to say that, but TLS readers and contributors you often do, because they're always reading, you know, Proust and so on.
Well, we exist on different timelines.
Yeah, exactly. And they can be in any language, published in any country. And we do try to remind contributors, I'm quoting from my own email here, that we prefer it if your selection was not the work of a friend, relation, partner, or close colleague.
Again.
David, I wonder why you put that in.
I don't think the literary world is known at all for log rolling, favour doing, back scratching or anything like that. And certainly we have none of that here at the TLS.
I've never even heard the word log rolling used in any context other than this sort of context, apart from the true lumberjacking way, I suppose.
I still don't really know what lumberjacks do. I think that's how they shift them down the river. But
Is that how they get them down to the river?
Yeah.
Or on the river.
On the river and along it. Yeah.
If anyone has first-hand experience of actual log rolling, please do tell us what
please
it
do.
Is, because we only know the second-hand inferior literary type.
And some people seem to impose their own rules on the game, don't they? I'm thinking of Mary Beard, who she chooses a museum or gallery catalogue every year.
Yes, well, I think Mary, being rather a senior academic and who's interested in her subject very much, so is inclined to choose a classical book, but then realizes that nearly all of them are by friends or colleagues, which is fair enough. So she religiously tends to choose books which aren't really single author works or whatever, tend to relate to more or less abstruse exhibitions in Greece and Rome and sometimes further afield.
Which has that added kind of benefit of giving these things that otherwise don't tend to have a very long shelf life. You know, they tend to disappear when the exhibition does. It's nice to give them a slightly longer life.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I like her contributions very much.
For the fullness of the picture, the one that she's mentioning this year is 1821, before and after Greeks and Greece, revolution and state. And it's a vast, I think 1,200-page catalogue of a commemorative exhibition at the Benaki Museum in Athens, which explores the origins of the revolution, because it's the 200th anniversary of the Greek Revolution this year, the uprising and its memory, and what happened next. So that's the first one. But here's how we'll proceed from here. In the first half of the show, we'll point to some of the, we think, most interesting nominations. And then in the second half, we're going to humbly offer our own. So, Toby, would you start things off, please?
Yes, I'm very happy to start things off. I am actually going to start at the beginning with David Aboulafia, not because I couldn't be bothered to read the other 64 entries, I promise you.
Nobody was going to suggest such a
No, but I just thought I'd nip that in the bud in case, you know, someone started thinking of that. But because he has selected, he's selected three books, but one of them is The Passenger by Alexander Boschwitz. Ulrich Alexander Boschwitz. And this is a novel I read earlier this year. It's brilliant. It is a rediscovered German novel that was written in 1939, published in 1939, by this forgotten author. The reason he's forgotten is that he died 3 years later. He was a refugee who ended up in Britain and then was sent to Australia in the way that many enemy aliens, so-called enemy aliens at the time, were. And on his return back to Britain, I think in 1942, his boat was torpedoed. And he'd written two novels by this stage. One of them was called The Passenger. It wasn't called that then. It was called The Man Who Took Trains. And he had various revisions. There's a long and complex backstory to this book. He had another version of it, which got lost as well. He had various revisions, which sunk at sea. But he'd also sent many letters to his mother about his revisions for this book, which ended up in this archive, sat in this archive for many, many decades. They, along with the novel itself, were sort of rediscovered in Germany about 4 or 5 years ago. It was published a couple of years ago, I think 3 years ago, perhaps. Anyway, it has been translated this year for Pushkin Press, translated by Philip Bohm, and came out. And it's actually caused quite a stir. I mean, I think it's the only appearance in Books of the Year, but it's certainly got a fair amount of coverage. It's basically, it's set during Kristallnacht. So, you know, it was written very soon after Kristallnacht, and it is set in the days during and after Kristallnacht, and basically features this German businessman who sort of barely even considers himself Jewish and was sort of almost quite dismissive of his other Jewish Berliners. But he suddenly realizes that his time is fast coming to an end, and he's basically on the run. And he's realized that his safest means of remaining in Germany is just to be in transit. And it's this extraordinary, feverish, slightly absurdist, farcical, but also disturbing series of journeys crisscrossing Germany as the net closes in on him. And it's really, really brilliant. And it's apparently the first literary representation of Kristallnacht. I don't know whether that's true. That's what the book, you know, that's what the introduction to the book claims. But, you know, as a historical document, it's very interesting as well.
The first as in it was written the soonest to be written afterwards.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. I mean, there'd obviously been various journalistic reports and the rest of it, but it's the, you know, it came out, you know, months. I think it was written in a month. And this is not the original version, this is the revised version, so I imagine it was slightly more all over the place, the first version. But yeah, it came out, I think, maybe 7-8 months after Kristallnacht, so it's sort of, you know, it's the first literary representation of Kristallnacht, and I would, you know, really urge anyone, not even just with an interest in that period, but just interest in literature full stop, to read it, because it's really good. It's really, really good.
That sounds fascinating.
So that was a good choice, I think. His other choices are interesting as well, actually, David Aboulafia. There's
You really didn't get beyond David Aboulafia, did you?
No, I didn't. Sorry. Well, one of the other two is by Lia Ipi, I think that's how you pronounce it. It's called Free Coming of Age at the End of History. And it's a memoir of growing up in Albania, in communist Albania. And I am interested in it because I actually went to see her speak. And she was fascinating about that. And I have the book, but I haven't read it yet. So I won't talk at length about that. But anyway, he has good choices.
And that one's come up in one or two other people's selections as well. I think Terry Apter mentions it.
She does, yeah. And we reviewed it, I think, a couple of weeks ago, 2-3 weeks ago. Misha Glenny reviewed it and was very full of praise for it. It looks, I mean, I actually started it the other day. It looks really, really fascinating. Mm. And she's a philosopher, but it's not really about sort of philosophy. It's very much a memoir. And it's a very interesting window onto that period of history. So that's Abulafia. Do you want me to go on with another one? Or
go on, I'll give you one more.
Okay, okay. Well, the other one is, it's actually Sarah Moss's choice. And it is the novel Burnt Coat by Sarah Hall. I must confess a vested interest in this because I'm interviewing both Sarah Moss and Sarah Hall at Hay in a few days' time. It's the Hay Winter Weekend. And they both of these Sarahs have written these pandemic novels. Not an easy thing to do, you know, when you're sort of essentially writing about the real world around you. And I'm very pleased to see that Sarah Moss likes Sarah Hall's novel a lot.
Because that's going to help your weekend, isn't it?
Could have been very awkward otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. But I can say both are great. And the Sarah Hall novel, which we gave a slightly disobliging review to the paper. Maybe not disobliging, but not entirely obliging. So I hadn't read the book when I was editing the review, and I sort of felt slightly worried about the whole thing, and then I read the book and it's totally brilliant. I think it's really, really beautifully done. I won't give you the sort of the long précis, but it's basically it's sort of set in an alternative England in which there was a pandemic which was much worse, even worse than our COVID-19 of the past 18 months has been, and it's been far more destructive, and there has been a breakdown of civil society. And it's this woman sort of looking back on that period. She's a sculptor. And she had a love affair during this period, and she's sort of looking back on the country and her own life and affair and her art and her relationship with her mother. And it's just really beautiful. And you know, there will be many pandemic novels, and there are already many pandemic novels, but this is certainly one to go and get if you haven't already got it or read it.
I like the sound of another book chosen by Sarah Moss. She says, I was diverted and delighted by Jackie Polzin's Brood, which is published by Picador, a novel in some ways about raising chickens, but also about being in America and loving and grieving and coping when things fall apart. And I think partly what I like about that, apart from the chickens, is the absence of the word pandemic.
I suppose you already have one pandemic in there, you know, in her entry. So that is quite enough.
Yeah, exactly. Lucy, whose contributions did you most enjoy?
Well, we're doing it on the basis of whose, if it was someone's, am I getting my seasons mixed up? When we do it for summer, it's whose holiday bag would you like to rob?
I don't know. I don't think we ever really clarified. Sort of imagining who, if you had to be gifted books by these people.
Oh, yeah.
Whose gift would you accept most willingly?
Yes, I'd be very happy. So I don't have to actually steal it out of their bags. They're going to give them to me willingly.
They're going to give them to you willingly, I imagine.
Good. I'm pleased. Then I would like our own Ruth Skirr to give me Colin Jones's The Fall of Robespierre, 24 Hours in Revolutionary Paris, because apparently it really is. It goes hour by hour, the day and night of his downfall, which I think I would find really fascinating. And I mean, it's all very grim.
And is the revelation that it wasn't as planned as people tend to think?
Yeah. That it was that stuff kind of happened, and you know, there were movements, and it was by no means a done deal, I don't think, what was going to happen. I mean, like quite a lot of the revolution, David knows this much better than me. Yes, it wasn't, you know, coldly necessarily planned out in advance. It was based on happenstance and movements and just all sorts of things. And I think it just sounds really fascinating. Another present I would like from Gabriel Joseph Avicii, because he chose The Tomb Guardians by Paul Griffiths, who has been on the podcast a few times and writes for us. And I read Paul's, I've read the one before that, Mr. Beethoven, his book about Beethoven, which is wonderful. So I would very much like to read The Tomb Guardians, which is about art. I think it's about people sort of looking at a work of art. I'm going to be, this is very vague here. And then the people in the work of art.
Is it something about how looking at art is a kind of a loophole in the otherwise difficult act of maintaining concentration or something like that?
That sounds a lot more clever than what I said. So, yeah, I think it's that.
No, it actually makes sense what I said.
I would also, well, I've already got Paul Griffiths's, one of his own books of the year was Jan Swofford's Mozart, which I have got and have read a little bit of and is just lovely. It's just lovely and makes me feel very good because it he's very keen on the magic flute, as am I, and a lot of people are very sniffy about the magic flute. So I'm happy to have Jan Swofford's backing about that.
You are very keen on the magic flute, aren't you?
I am. I can't help it. It's terrific. Two more.
You're allowed one more.
Oh, one more.
Well, go on then. Two more. Well, I don't know. I gave Toby three.
Two more, but I'll say it very quickly.
Go on then.
Okay. One, Fungi by Merlin Sheldrake. Andrew Motion chose it. It's just all about basically fungi. Like, we couldn't really exist without them, because they are so prevalent. They are responsible for decomposition and for fermentation and for feeding the trees and for all sorts of things. And they're completely fascinating.
He uses the word intelligence very, very cautiously, doesn't he? But it's difficult to think of a better word for it.
Yeah. Well, they send, I mean, it's like all that stuff we learned about the trees. They send signals to each other. They just simply do. They communicate. I mean, by almost any definition, they communicate.
He says it's groundbreaking, which obviously...
He does. I love that.
Hilarious.
Actually hilarious. And the one more that I would like to read is in Raymond Tallis's selection, Humankind, A Hopeful History, by the Dutch historian and journalist Rutger Bregman. He says, his assault on the dangerous, destructive assumption that a positive view of humanity is shallow while pessimism reveals the profound truth about us is a tour de force. Which I think is very interesting, and I've long been interested in that, and I would like to read a whole book about it. There you go. I did too many, and I'm sorry.
Well, I was expecting you to choose Peter Thoneman's selection of Alan Garner. Are you not an Alan Garner fan? I just assumed you would be.
Yeah, no. As soon as I was reading back over it, I thought, oh, I must say Alan Garner as well. But you
go on then. Say Alan Garner.
Also Alan Garner, please.
You can look out for a review, by the way, of Alan Garner in next week's edition, I should say.
And the book is called Treacle Walker, is that right?
Yeah, it's a great piece, actually.
And Peter Thoneman describes it as a deep excavation of a single acre or so of land on Garner's home turf of Alderley Edge.
It's all about Alderley Edge. Everything is always about Alderley Edge.
He says he's a novelist who writes like an archaeologist thinks, which seems a very good way of putting it.
Yes, and he's also able to do that amazing thing, Alan Garner, of sort of all superimposing the past on the present, and it's fine. Do you know what I mean? You can sort of make sense of it.
David, whose selection or selections have captured your attention?
Well, I liked Lisa Hilton's selection. I haven't been reading very many novels this year at all. And Lisa Hilton has chosen a novel that I'd like to read by Catherine Heine called Early Morning Riser. And the reason I've chosen it is just because she sounds like my kind of novelist. She sounds a bit like Anne Tyler or Elizabeth Strauss or even Miss Munro. It's that kind of depths of ordinary life, but fantastically kind of sensitive and also rather funny. I had a look at sort of previous reviews of Heine. I saw that Claire Loudon, whose judgment I trust very, very much, called her first collection a funny book that should be taken very seriously indeed. And Lisa Hilton says about this one, she says, it explores two decades in the life of Jane, a primary school teacher in small town Michigan, and her partner Duncan, the Don Juan of the Midwest. And, you know, how could you not want to read all about those people? And apparently it's wincingly acute. So that was one that I was immediately drawn to. And another almost opposite direction, slightly different vein, is Frederick Raphael's, one of his choices, which is the Greek Lexicon. ancient Greek to English. And we had a review of a lead review by the aforementioned Peter Toneman, who's a classicist, who isn't particularly well disposed to big reference books, because he says you can get most of what they got on them, got in them on the internet. But even he called this book a truly astonishing piece of work. And the reason is that it's more than just a sort of updated dictionary. James Diggle, the editor, and his colleagues have basically reread the whole of ancient Greek literature and sort of filtered in their definitions of the whole language from that. And the inimitable Frederick Raphael calls the dictionary boldly outspoken in malis partibus.
Of course he does.
Of course he does, using Latin to describe a Greek dictionary. Who wouldn't? And I'm sure, pretty sure what he means by that is that it's good on the rude words. And noticeably, I mean, anybody who learns ancient Greek for more than about 5 minutes, especially if they did it as a silly adolescent, knows that there are lots of rude words in ancient Greek. I'm not sure if they're still there in modern Greek. And the ways they were translated in older dictionaries is always rather sort of coy. Peter Toneman has a good example. He says that the word sauloproktio, which was translated as to walk in a swaggering way so as to make the hinder parts sway to and fro, I hope you're with me, it's now simply translated as to wiggle one's ass, which makes a bit more sense.
Hinder parts is quite something, isn't it? It sounds like Liddell and Scott made up their hinder parts.
Your hinder parts. Yeah, exactly. Well, I think it's sort of as if you're a horse sort of thing. And I have sort of held a copy of this book in my hand because I bought it as a present for someone and then had to give it away. And it is fantastic. It's an amazing two-volume thing. And I mean, it's the Cambridge University Press. And it's £50, which seems to me, for such an enormous work of scholarship of decades and decades, considering quite a lot of small monographs are about that much, actually amazingly good value.
Indeed, for all the joy it will bring.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So what you did, David, is the classic thing of getting a reference book and looking up the rude words, is that right?
Well, I didn't look up the rude words.
No, not you.
Both Frederick Raphael and Peter Toneman. Although Frederick Raphael also remarks about a reference to Aeschylus that he cleverly makes, which I half understood. But I shall be pursuing other things like that if I can borrow back in that classic way of giving a present that you hope to get back yourself. Borrow back the dictionary.
The point about swear words reminds me of Paul Muldoon's pick of books this year. He says, in the 10 years I spent as poetry editor of the New Yorker, I came to marvel at the work done by the magazine's team of fact checkers. The Poet's Mistake by Erica McAlpine, published by Princeton, is a winning catalogue of flaws and fuck-ups. It includes Robert Browning thinking a twat was an item of dress for a nun.
Yes, very good, isn't it?
Do you think somebody told Robert Browning that as a jape and then didn't?
I'd love to see that letter.
No, I think it's actually in a poem of Browning.
Oh, it made it through.
Yeah, I think someone will leap onto Twitter and tell me I'm wrong, but I think that's right. And it can only mean that he thinks, you know, it's like a wimple or something. Yeah. And I'm sorry, really isn't.
Dear.
What about your books, Thea? What would you go for?
Well, I was sort of hoping that David might mention this book because he's the historian. And I merely feel like I should mention it to render some kind of service to my country people. But it's an Italian history book and it sounds very important and fascinating. It's called Di Dolore Ostello, which means sort of House of Pain. It's a Dante reference, but it's Pagine di Storia Italiana, which is Pages of Italian History. And it's edited by Paolo Bernardini. And this was chosen by Felipe Fernandez Armesto. And it seems like a really interesting concept. It's based on the premise that Italian history has been just magnificent, which is a very generous word, I suppose, magnificent but painful series of clashes and battles and misunderstandings and invasions, and all of this makes it unique, obviously. And so this book goes through 37 volumes of Italian history, published in either in Italian or abroad, published in the past 10 years, and kind of, I think, just presents them as kind of fragments. I'm sort of imagining, I haven't seen the book, but I'm imagining this really incredible modernist retelling of history in which these fragments enter into a kind of dialogue with each other, which just sounds like, if it is what I am imagining, then it sounds like a very clever and original contribution, I think. So I just wanted to mention that, as I felt I should. But I do genuinely really, really like the sound of, as in would like to be gifted, a book mentioned by Marina Warner, which is called Accidental Gods on Men Unwittingly Turned Divine. And it's published by Metropolitan, and it's by Anna de la Subin. And it traces this line of history which sees cults appear centered on strange, unlikely candidates. So there's Captain Cook, Prince Philip is an obvious one. So that's a reference to the religious sect, followed by, but have you heard of it? It's the Caston people in Vanuatu.
I have, vaguely, yes, yeah.
It's cargo cults, aren't they? They're called cargo cults, those ones, yeah.
Exactly, and so they believe in the divinity of the late Duke of Edinburgh. So Marina Warner says, Voltairean mockery would be easy, and it certainly would, it is. But the book's strength lies in the sensitivity of her analysis, which hones in on the interrelations of power and powerlessness, colonialism and nationalism, worship as a response to terror and a desire to propitiate. So I think that sounds fascinating. And I thought it was out in January, so I'm not sure if she might be breaking the rules. Maybe it came out earlier in America.
I think there's an American version, which is the one that she's seen.
The other book I was drawn to is one that Stephen Brown mentions. He says, War and Peace was published 57 years after Napoleon invaded Russia, and Almudena Grandes is The Frozen Heart, El Corazón Helado, published by Weidenfeld, came 68 years after the Spanish Civil War. He says, I draw the comparison deliberately, but cannot defend it without collapsing into tired phrases like acute observation, meticulous research, compelling characterization, the evocation of an era. Better just to sum it up as betrayal, 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 betrayal. So that just sounds like a bloody good novel. So I would take that one.
Like a fun read.
Yes, exactly. Bit of betrayal, I think, was the thing I picked up from that.
Yeah. That's the theme.
Any surprising omissions? I was quite surprised not to see Sally Rooney, purely because I'm sure she's featured on every Books of the Year roundup for the past couple of years.
But isn't everyone over Sally Rooney? Isn't that the thing? That you can't say Sally Rooney now, because, you know, the third one wasn't as good as the first two, and everyone's moved on.
Oh, fair enough. Any other surprising omissions?
It's such a good question that we're thinking very deeply about it. I feel bad for Sally Rooney.
Did The Promise get mentioned? I don't think I saw The Promise.
Oh, no, it didn't.
I've only just realised that. But yeah, so the Booker winner, The Promise, which is extremely good.
Well done, Toby.
Yes, that's an interesting omission, actually. Yeah.
Well, then we refer listeners back 2 episodes, is it? A couple of weeks ago, you interviewed Damon Galgut?
A couple of weeks ago.
So we can remedy that one easily enough.
For any listeners who are interested in the Browning twat reference, I have looked it up.
Oh,
I think we all are, let's face it.
I think we all are.
It comes from a poem called Pippa Passes. And this is the section in which he uses the word. I'm just going to launch straight into it. But at night, brother Howlett, far over the woods, toll the world to thy chantry, sing to the bats sleek sisterhoods, full compliance with gallantry. Then owls and bats, cowls and twats, monks and nuns in cloisters moods, adjourn to the oak stump pantry. So even better than that, according to the site that I have found this on, he got the word from a poem of 1660 called Vanity of Vanities. In fact, I'll read the line from that. They talked of his having a cardinal's hat. They'd send him as soon as an old nun's twat. And he misinterpreted this to believe that a twat was a wimple.
Oh, bless him.
So there you go.
Gosh. Thank you. I'm so grateful.
I'm stunned into silence now.
Poor Robert Browning. Pippa Passes is about, you know, 300 pages long or something. And that's all he's going to be remembered for that poem.
It's a very famous poem, isn't it?
It's a great poem, yeah. Yes, because she passes by. It's her one free day of the year, poor Pippa. She works every day of the year, and he follows her passage, as I vaguely remember this poem, around as she passes outside much richer and happier people's doors and windows and listens in. Poor Robert Browning.
Well, you took something that was funny and made it very melancholy, David.
Always here.
Well, or he stopped us just talking about the rude word and talked about the great work of literature in which the rude word is embedded.
Never again.
An elevated thing somewhat. Right, well, I think we should leave it there now. Still to come on the show, after digesting other people's selections for books of the year, we editors shall make our own. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, perhaps you'll consider subscribing to the TLS itself. Should you wish to do so, you'll find all the options and details online at the-tls.co.uk, which is also where I believe you will find the Books of the Year feature in its massive entirety.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi and I'm here with Lucy Dallas, David Horsepool and Toby Lichtig, and we're working our way through 12 months of the best books as chosen by some of our contributors. So now it's time to bring our own favourites into the fold. Who wants to go first? David?
All right then. I was holding back from the ones that have been omitted because I'm going to stick to the same rules that we ask our contributors to follow. So I won't mention my friend Francis Wilson's brilliant biography of D.H. Lawrence, Burning Man. But I'll point you instead in the direction of Ronald Hutton's book, The Making of Oliver Cromwell, which is the first volume of a projected two-volume biography. And Hutton knows that, you know, Cromwell's been written about quite a lot, but also that nobody's really nailed him down yet. He's very McCavity the mystery cat.
David, I think you're being very modest here. One person has definitively nailed him down, I think, in the past few years. There's one book about him.
We can unequivocally recommend.
That
couldn't be more untrue, though, as well. You're referring to a tiny book that I wrote, which particularly concentrated on him as a sort of quasi-king, because it was part of a series about monarchs. And this Rhonda Hutton's book is, certainly this volume is, only takes him up to the end of the First Civil War, when Charles handed himself over to the Scots, who then passed him eventually to the English. And so we've still got a long way to go before Cromwell ends up there. And I like to think, because he had a lot more room than me, Rhonda Hutton's particular, I think, as well as he really does seem to have a really full picture of Cromwell. What I really especially liked about the book was he puts in this kind of fantastic background of the landscape and the way the world would have looked and felt at the time of Cromwell. So you get the kind of the water world that he grew up in Huntingdon and St Ives and Ely, it's just around the Great Ouse. And then when we move to London, he doesn't, I mean, every other biographer would just sort of say he started his career in Parliament, this is what happened, these are the times when he spoke. But Ronald Hutton starts off by telling us exactly where he would have been, what Parliament looked like. It was the rebuilt 14th century St. Stephen's Chapel and the medieval palace of Westminster. And he tells us about its very high roof and its double tier of Gothic windows, and whether they were glazed with painted windows or clear, you know, what the place looked like and what it felt like, and what a vote entailed. Rather interesting to me, a vote in Parliament, in those, it doesn't sound massively different to a pre-pandemic, at least, vote now. I mean, the whole locking the lobbies thing that, you know, had already begun then, and tellers counted everyone back in. We really do exactly what we did over 300 years ago in that respect.
I think you can always tell with biographies. Is Hutton, you know, is he sympathetic? Is he well disposed to his subject? Is there a warmth?
That's a really good question. I think he's careful not to sort of buy into Cromwell too much, which I suppose as a sort of modern, unless you happen to be fanatically religious yourself, I mean, a lot more than sort of just a believer, you probably wouldn't buy into Cromwell's world outlook. But Cromwell sort of genuinely believed what he believed and believed in the rightness of his cause, and thought and was a man of his time in some of the ways that he acted. But he also, Hutton shows, that he was a great self-promoter. He was quite canny about using the medium of print to make sure that his name was always in the front of things. And yet you can't actually pin him down for having done that himself. There's no point at which you can say, aha, look at him saying it was all me. In fact, he makes a great point of writing letters to Parliament saying, give all the glory to God. You know, I just happened to be there, kind of thing, after another victory. But the effect is to constantly promote Cromwell, who, after all, by the end of the First Civil War, was not in charge of anything beyond the cavalry of Parliament. He was Lieutenant General of Parliamentary Horse, but he had become the kind of star attraction of the parliamentary cause. And as the country descended back into civil war, he would kind of come up further, but that will be for the next Hutton volume, which I'm really looking forward to.
And when will that come?
I would not be surprised if the next volume appears next year, but equally well, it is a massive undertaking, so one could give him a little bit more time.
Lucy, what book or books would you like to talk about then?
Well, I was thinking about this, as is only right and proper, and slightly to my own surprise, I think I would, one of them is Clara and the Sun by Katsuro Ishiguro, which if you'd asked me just after I'd read it, I'd have said, oh, I don't know about Book of the Year, you know, thought was very interesting and all of that, but it sort of stayed with me. And it's I think it's very difficult to do what he's done. It seems very simple. And I think something seeming that simple that actually has got an awful lot of thought and emotion and sort of questioning behind it, I think that's very difficult.
What has he done, just for anyone who missed it?
Clara is a robot, an AI. And she is a companion to a child, and it's about illness. The child becomes ill, and there's a question about what Clara's role is going to be in the family. But there's it makes you think and care about all sorts of things. One of them is, Anne Enright did a very good review of it in another publication other than the TLS, so I probably shouldn't mention it. and she did it was a brilliant review, and the only problem I had with it was the first line, because she said something like, he wants to make us care about a robot, and the funny thing is, we do. I didn't find that funny at all. I'm always moaning on that in science fiction, people have been writing robots that you care deeply about and AI for years and years and years. But he does a very good job of making you care about the robot, but also about the humans. And you have to think about the relationships between the robots and the humans, how they treat each other. And in the near future in which it's set, there's a distinction between different sorts of humans as well, as it were, because of the rise of technology. And it's very, as I say, it seems very simple. But I don't think it is.
I completely agree with you, Lucy. I read this earlier in the year and I was really blown away by it. And I was a bit anxious because I'm a big fan of Ishiguro, but I also have felt that his last few books actually have been not quite as good as his earlier work. And I always come back to his what I call his masterwork, The Unconsoled, which was written in the mid-90s. And this sort of has, the new one has the kind of the turbulent surrealism of it, and I think it is the best book he's written since then. His best book in about 25 years or so. I really thought it was brilliant. And interestingly, Ishiguro's great friend Ian McEwan also took on the robot book, as it were, a couple of years previously, Machines Like Me. And it is a very hard thing to do. And I think the McEwan book it's good. I like it more than lots of other people do, but it's pretty flawed. And I think the Ishiguro book is much, much better. And I think he's really taken on that difficult theme and really succeeded. Obviously he's a huge name, he's a Nobel Prize winner now. It's a brilliant book and it was very well reviewed, and I sort of feel everyone's sort of forgotten about it now. It only came out about 7 or 8 months ago, and I'm glad you brought it up, because actually I'd almost forgotten about it and I wasn't particularly going to mention it today.
But that's what I mean, it sort of stayed with me, and I don't think my initial reaction was as strong as yours. I liked it, I really liked it. But it's still around, as it were. So I sort of like it even more from a distance, as it were. I also would recommend Tamima Annam's The Startup Wife, which is also about tech as well, actually. It's really good, fun novel about tech and sort of social media. It's not all fun, actually, but some of it is. It's very sharp and quick. It's some of the best writing about sort of workplace and tech that I've read. I think there's quite a lot of sort of broad attempts at writing about people in tech from people who aren't in tech. I think it's quite difficult to do, and that's just a really, really, really good novel. And can I cheat to do one more?
Go on then.
It's a massive cheat because it's not from 2021, so one of those cheats. I just was I read Richard Powers' The Overstory, because it was just really terrific, and that's really stayed with me as well. And it's also a bit like your one that you mentioned about, it's about chickens and it's about grief and loneliness, and this one is about all sorts of things, but it's also about trees, so it tells you stuff and you get a whole wonderful fictional world along with the stuff which is real and, you know, tangible and very urgent, actually.
And that's three novels there, Lucy. Have you found yourself, I don't know, reading more fiction than in previous years? Or I'm only asking because I've definitely been reading more fiction in the past 12 months than in any other year, I think. And I don't know why that is, apart from just I could lazily explain it as some kind of retreat from the world and from the present moment.
I don't know, maybe. Yes, maybe a bit more. But actually part of the reason I like all three of them is because they're absolutely about stuff that's going on. So it's not that they don't feel relevant, but not relevant in a kind of...
Not in a newsy way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Particularly The Overstory, which has a kind of sort of time on it, because it's talking about trees. So it goes back as old as the oldest trees, which is pretty old.
Toby, how about you? What have you enjoyed this year?
Slightly unsurprisingly, given that I'm the fiction editor, I have read quite a lot of fiction. I think it's been an incredibly good year for fiction. I really do. I think I think the Booker long list reflected that. We had Ishiguro on it. As you know, I'm a big fan of the Damon Galgut. I liked Richard Powers's follow-up novel, Bewilderment, very much, which was shortlisted. There's the new Jonathan Franzen, which I think, Thea, you might want to talk about. I've mentioned Sarah Hall already. I mean, there was just some really fascinating stuff, a novel that came out earlier in the year by a debut novelist called Raven Lalani, called Luster. But anyway, I'm not going to trot through everything, but there are a couple of novels that didn't sort of make any prize list that I just want to quickly flag, because they're both brilliant. And actually, they both did make their way into Books of the Year. One is by Gwendolyn Riley. It's called My Phantoms. And it was the choice of DJ Taylor. And it's if you like Gwendolyn Riley, you will love this book. It's just very, very her. It's icy cool. It's about a very difficult relationship between a mother and her daughter, or rather a daughter and her mother, because the daughter is the narrator. It takes the same structure and form, really, and theme of pretty much all her fiction. It's just Gwendolyn Riley writing at the height of her powers. It is so acutely observed. She really nails this very particular sort of repressed Englishness. It's very funny. I'm going to read DJ Taylor's description, because I think he'll do a better job than me. He calls it a wonderfully edgy account of a mother-daughter relationship running into trouble, full of the nervy dialogue and head-on psychological collisions for which Riley really ought to take out some kind of patent. And he's quite right about that. It's really, really good. And she is one of my favourite contemporary authors. Another book is by Natasha Brown, a debut novelist. It's called Assembly. This one was chosen by Anna Katarina Schaff. And I read it earlier in the year, and I was just completely bowled over by the prose. It's just, again, it's the sort of the observational quality. Not an awful lot happens. It's about a young black woman and her relationship with her posh white boyfriend and his family. And she basically goes to stay with them for a weekend and has to deal with all the class and race tensions that come with that. She works for a bank and has had to deal with, a lot of those issues during the course of her job. And it's just the kind of the observations of contemporary Britain and what it is to be a young black woman striving in this, very difficult culture to strive in. And it's just really beautifully, brilliantly done. So I massively recommend that to anyone.
Anna Katarina Schaffner says, at the novel's heart is a deeply disturbing Bartleby-esque act of existential refusal.
Well, I can slightly allude to that, because I'm not giving too much away. Basically, at the beginning, we learn that she's very unwell. She's diagnosed with cancer, and she's sort of running through the book is this sort of question about of what to do with this diagnosis. It's really brilliant. The other one, just to move away from fiction, and I did mention this on the podcast a while ago, I think, is it's a book that was out last month called The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity, by the late anthropologist David Graeber, who was also integral to the Occupy movement. He was an anarchist, and this was sort of his meisterwork. He'd been working on it for about 10 or 12 years, and he very, very sadly died just as the manuscript was getting ready. He wrote it in conjunction with an archaeologist called David Vengro, and it's basically one of those deep histories that seeks to overturn all those other quite blokey deep histories, the sort of Jared Diamonds and Yuval Noah Harari's sort of history of civilization. It's very, very complicated, but its general thesis is to sort of overturn this idea of the primitive savage, and it sort of starts off by critiquing where the idea of the primitive savage came from in the 18th century, and then to sort of discuss the political implications of this and the way it's sort of been used by both the left and right. But it basically trawls through the last 30,000 years plus of history to sort of look at the different ways in which we've organized ourselves, and just to give a far more complex portrait of human organization and hierarchy and subjugation and structuring, I guess, than sort of we have previously thought. It's pretty tendentious in places, I would say. I mean, there's lots of kind of like using very particular examples to extrapolate, and I think it's kind of, it's meant to get you thinking and to sort of cause arguments as much as anything else. But I've found it really formidable.
It sounds like there might be some overlap as well with the book that Lucy mentioned earlier, Raymond Tallis's selection, Humankind, A Hopeful History, by the Dutch historian and journalist Rutger Bregman. If it is that sense of overturning the idea of an intrinsic violence
Well, actually, it is, because so one of their contentions is that, you know, sort of this idea that as soon as we started farming and settling and organizing into society, that's when inequality began. And that sort of, you know, and sort of contemporary inequality and all the violence that goes with that stems from that. It completely sort of unsettles that and says, well, no, actually, we were very unequal at times when we were hunter-gatherers, and we were also not necessarily unequal when we were settling. Anyway, it wasn't as simple as that, because everyone was doing different things at different times for different purposes, and therefore nothing is set. And sort of the optimism of it is, therefore, you know, our world is a blank slate, and we can, you know, we can do whatever we want to do. Yeah, I think it probably does do a very sort of similar sort of unsettling.
Well, you hesitated, I think, before. You were hesitating over whether or not to mention Jonathan Franzen, and then you said that I would.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I'm not really sure if I should or I shouldn't, really, because it would be wrong of me to say that it's my book of the year or one of my books of the year, because I haven't finished reading it. I'm not that far into it, but I'm enjoying it, so I can say that. I think I hesitate, and I don't know whether this is also why you hesitate or not, but to mention him, because he can be a bit shallow, a bit zeitgeisty, I suppose. Whereas this one seems more mature. And as I say, I'm only about, you know, only about 80 pages in, and I think it's 500 pages long, so I really can't say it's one of my books of the year. But I bought it on the strength of Edmund Gordon's review in our pages. It was that convinced me, because he said, he summed it up as, Crossroads is largely free from the vices to which Franzen's previous work has been addicted. The self-conscious topicality, the show-off sophistication, the formal heavy-handedness. It retains many of his familiar virtues, the robust characterization, the escalating comedy, the virtuosic command of narrative rhythm. So it's a very traditional novel. He says both in its form, it's about the various members of an unhappy family. And there's a third person, omniscient narrator, and it's about their preoccupations. So it's very simple. It's, you know, faith, love, generational strife, this kind of vague but powerful idea of virtue, what it is to be good. And it centers on the Hildebrands family. I suppose what I find interesting, apart from the fact that it seems like Franzen has perhaps, it seems strange to say this of a man who's not exactly a spring chicken, but he seems to have matured perhaps in this novel.
I think you're absolutely right. I have read it all. I think Edmund's take was absolutely spot on. And I think your decision to read it on the back of that piece is spot on as well. So it's the first part of a trilogy. It's set in 1971, hence the sort of the lack of topicalities, you know, the way at least he's been able to squirm free of some of the more obvious topicalities. I just think it's totally brilliant. It's, as you say, it's pretty traditional. It's very funny. It's very moving in places. It's got the element of religion in it, which none of his previous novels have. He grew up in this, well, you know, when he's a teenager, he joined this sort of kind of hippie-ish Christian community. And that's an interesting aspect to it. But, it's been a long time since I read The Corrections, which is generally regarded as his best work. And I really think it's up there with that. I think it's really, really impressive. And I'm extremely excited about the next two. I mean, you know, they'll probably come out slowly. They're big novels, and he takes his time, and you know, so should he. It's just great. It's funny. It's really nice to be made to laugh by a book.
Yes, but I think that's partly it. Okay, so I'll persist with that, and maybe it will be my book of the year for next year. Although there's a whole 12 months between now and then, so who could possibly say? So one of my actual books of 2021. I'm on much firmer footing here. It's also centered, funnily enough, on a man of the cloth, sort of. So it's The Books of Jacob by Olga Tokarczuk. And I have to give the full title here. So it's The Books of Jacob, or A Fantastic Journey Across 7 Borders, 5 Languages, and 3 Major Religions, not counting the minor sects. told by the dead, supplemented by the author, drawing from a range of books and aided by imagination, the witch being the greatest natural gift of any person, that the wise might have it for a record, that my compatriots reflect, lay persons gain some understanding, and melancholy souls obtain some slight enjoyment. And
that's a brilliant title.
It's wonderful. It takes up the whole of the... I have a proof copy of it and it takes up the whole of the front cover. I don't know how they'll style it on the finished one. I haven't taken a look, but I mean, it's Fitzcarraldo. So the book design is always just a very simple one, just blue for fiction with the whole title on the page. So I don't see how else they could do it, but it is wonderful. And it does sum up the whole book. It's this vast sweeping historical novel. It's like 1,000 pages long. I have it here. So it's 1,000 pages long. And this is what it sounds like when I drop it on the table. I think the book itself took almost a decade to write, and it really shows the depth of the research and the thought and the vision, because it's not just historical detail, it's philosophical kind of engagement as well on Tokarczuk's part. And it's divided into 7 books, and it's basically the title subject is Jacob Frank, who's this Polish Jew who announced himself as the Second Coming in the second half of the 18th century. And the novel is a collection of other people's observations of him and his growing influence. And it's just incredible, really awe-inspiring work of multi-ventriloquism, I suppose. I can't even imagine how Jennifer Croft began to think about translating it. I really recommend it. I mean, it begins in 1750s Poland, which is part of Poland, which is now the Ukraine. And so we meet this strange and beguiling young Jewish man who seems to have come from nowhere. He seems like the definition of rootless. And he starts to have these divine experiences, and soon people start to attach themselves to him. And it all goes from there, really. And he's traveling widely and reinventing himself and being attacked one moment and chased out of town and revered the next. And his followers do exactly that. They follow him and they're looking for a land in which to settle and be free from persecution. But there's all of these wild stories circulating him and what he represents as well, you know, the sort of behavior that we tend to expect of a cult leader.
It dovetails with your the Marina
it War. it does. I seem to be completely obsessed with with religion and the ridiculousness of the ways in which it can be formed on the basis of just hope, really. I suppose that's the thing at the root of this book of the books of Jacob, is this message about how desperate we all are to believe in something that can save us. Now that you've said it, Lucy, I see that that's a thread that runs through every book that I've selected, whether a book that I've read or one that I want to read. So I don't know what my therapist will have to say about that.
But I was going to say, answers on a postcard, please.
I think we should probably leave it there before we get too deep into my soul.
Yeah, I think we should.
General observations. Anyone, anything else to add about this year?
Yes, I've got one thing to add. It was a choice by Paul Griffiths. He said he wanted to reread the novels of Rosalind Belbin because it's her 80th birthday. And I read that and thought, I don't know who Rosalind Belbin is. I don't know if anyone else had that experience.
Mm.
Then I looked her up and she looks really interesting. So there you go.
Time for a revival then.
Yeah, happy 80th birthday, Rosalind Belbin. And, you know, may your fiction be revived via Paul Griffiths and Books of the Year, because, you know, it looks like there's a very interesting back catalogue there.
Brilliant. So an end of the year becomes a beginning.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, that is all we have time for this week. We'll leave it on that very positive and regenerative note. Our thanks go to David Horspool and Toby Lichtig, and of course, Lucy Dallas. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast produced by Sophia Franklin. We'll be back next week, but from now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.